Avi Adoni Dodi. We enter into this study to draw close to you for the sake of holy service and the fulfillment of your will for us and for all of Israel and for this entire planet. Please assist our efforts and guide our understandings. Let us internalize your Torah to the depths of our being so that we become transformed by your will and its truths. Let neither ourselves nor anyone else come into stumbling as a result of this study. Gal einai va'abita nifla'ot me'toratecha. Hey. Yay, always good to see you. Open my eyes and see everybody.
Trying to connect to the phone with you, but it's not working.
What'd you
I'm
say?
trying to.
Someone talking to me? Talking. Who's someone needs to mute? Or were they talking to me? I couldn't understand. I couldn't hear. Okay, so we are in the last section of the book, the Practical Tools for Processing Shame. And which are three larger categories. There's a change of attitude, attitudinal change, that instead of just having a knee-jerk negative attitude and reaction towards shame, to understand from biblical tale and teaching tales that it is theoretically possible that shame could actually be a very positive and transformative tool if we are able to work with it properly, or like Aaron HaCohen worked with it and really kind of came into his persona as the Kohen Gadol as a result of where shame brought him. So that's the attitudinal piece. Then there is the proactive tools, which are preventative, like there's no shame threatening or no shame happening, but it's just tools of self-awareness that like to because the more self-aware we are, the more we're able to see what's going on for real, instead of the distortions of interpretation that come when shame kind of gets hold, its talons get hold of one's mind or perspective. And so basically the most useful tool of self-awareness is meditation in one form or another. And so the proactive tools included just basic meditation, just to be able to find your way, to create a practice that helps you to be able to find your way in real life to a kind of quiet, still, and undistorted interpretation of the experience of the moment. And so there was regular meditation. There was a meditation that is paying attention, also beginning to pay attention to the negative spaces of meditation, the place where meditation being a continuous flow of thought on a particular object or point of focus, you pick something as your focus, and then you get distracted and start thinking about other things, and you come back and you distract and come back. And that's meditation. And that effort of coming back and coming back and coming back is a tool that strengthens attention. But also beginning to pay attention to the negative spaces where your mind wanders, and oftentimes, and you begin to get a glimpse of what's happening in the lower, more subliminal layers of the psyche that are reacting and chattering to what's happening, but their whole conversation is outside your visual or auditory field because you're too busy reacting to what's happening in the moment. And so it is extremely helpful if you're meditating anyway to begin to pay attention to these, to what distracts you, and kind of begin to get a glimpse of your like spiritually unproductive self-talk that's happening there, that you basically things that you've been saying yourself to yourself since you've been 4 years old or whatever, and had a child's interpretation of reality, and now you're a grown-up, but you're still interpreting things. Your knee-jerk interpretation is still as a 4-year-old or a 7-year-old or whatever. So this practice of the negative spaces of meditation begins to expose that layer of conversation that's happening at the base of the psyche. And it is extremely useful information in terms of getting a glimpse of what your spiritually productive thought habits are, or as I always say, your personal lineage of neuroses. So that's that. And then the next journal exercise was more a kind of focusing on taking a look at the judgments that we make about people and about the world and about people's decisions and politics and all that kind of stuff. And there's a lot of intolerance that you know, it's certainly we're all free to have friend preferences and thought preferences and opinion preferences and all that, but we need to be able to do that in a context that is of also mutual respect. And so this journaling is just looking at the things that we are disrespectful of, and to try to understand why we get triggered by that, like where does our intolerance come from, and how can we frame things in a way that would continue to disagree with what we disagree with, but to do so in a way that is respectful of the person, at least gives that person a Dalit, extends to that person a Dalit amot where they are able to exist instead of feeling like they should be wiped off the planet. And then the final journaling or meditative journaling that we talked about last week is the narcissistic inventory of really kind of looking at narcissistic supply inventory, which is, it's not a narcissistic inventory. That was a bad mistake. It's a narcissistic supply inventory. Narcissistic supply is something that it's an essential need of every human being. We need food, we need shelter, we need drink, we need clothing, we need and we need narcissistic supply. We need a sense from which we can get from ourselves, from the world, from Hashem, but a sense of that we're good, that we're valuable, that we make a difference, that we're beautiful, that we're, you know, want desired. All these things, there's no shame in them at all, zero. But the question is, how do we go about getting this narcissistic supply? And there, that's really the question of, do we kind of, is there a trail of good deeds and good deeds that we leave behind as we move through life, and we kind of have, as a result of that, legitimately earned narcissistic supply? Or do we throw a tantrum, or do we withdraw, or do we make people afraid that we're going to get angry or disappear or whatever, and secure our narcissistic supply that way? It's very hard questions to ask oneself, but that is essential to being able to start to manage shame and shame spasms. I mean, just today I was going through my email, and I was just like, an email, this email, a little bit of narcissistic supply there. This email, none. This email, something like, just so just be aware of it's really no shame. It just, but I mean, I suggest that as an exercise, go through as you go through your emails. to see which ones, notice which ones give you narcissistic supply. So that we did last week, and people, I really like, really, 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 it's an important exercise to do a narcissistic supply inventory and to really be honest about where you get your narcissistic supply. Okay, and now we are on the, I think it's page 246, which is don't shame people. And so I let's see. Share. Okay, do you see something with highlights on the screen? Yeah, okay. So this
Yes.
is a little exercise that we're going to do, which is this is about this next section of proactive is like to begin to sensitize ourselves to how in very subtle ways we shame people. Like there's some kind of perverse pleasure or relief that is that the psyche gets, the unexamined, the unenlightened psyche gets from like causing someone, identifying someone's shame, speaking someone's shame, even though we do it in a way that we, is very subtle. And so no one could quite accuse us of being a shamer, but nevertheless, it's happening. And we're, it's like these, when I was growing up, there were these straws, and you put a pea in it, and you blow it, and it would send a pea shooter or something like that. That's how we were like shame. We just pea shoot shame, like little bullets of shame that we don't even necessarily know or recognize as that we're doing it. And so this is a, I didn't write this. I pulled it from the internet. But it's a two columns. One is the statement that you say, and it's there's a little bit of shame in there versus the non-shaming rephrase. So okay, so we'll go through it. Okay, so you're really sensitive. So that puts the blame on the trouble on the communication issue on the person's plate, on the other person's plate, and that they are over, like they're super sensitive, whereas the non-shaming phrase is, wow, I didn't realize that this would hit you that way. Can you tell me more? So it's acknowledging that that I didn't judge the situation correctly. I underestimated what the effect my words would have. So I'm taking the brunt of the blame and just asking for information rather than blaming. Or you're still working on that, which in instead of how's it going? Any part giving you trouble? Like there's no blame in the second. There's no, like the first one is implying that it's taking longer than it should, and that's a problem with the person who's doing the work. Whereas the second, the non-shaming rephrase is just it's very neutral. I mean, any part of, is it giving, are you having any trouble? Can I help you with that? Or shaming statement. Wait, does anybody want to say anything about these things, or should I just keep going through?
I
Okay.
love these examples, and I want to, if there's a point where we can ask about something, how we would rephrase something, when that comes up in your schedule here, I would love to ask you.
Okay. Well, do you see any of these that you would like to say? I mean,
Well, I see that I actually do this quite often because there's that part of me that is uncomfortable with myself not being on my game. I don't want to use the word perfectionist, but I don't like that feeling of just being behind the eight ball or just, I don't know. It's probably a self-esteem issue. So this is how I would like to ask you what I would do instead. So this morning, I have a call that is always scheduled either somewhere like around 8 o'clock or 9 o'clock, but usually around nine.
But wait a minute. Is this going to be
No.
about saying
A
the statement
shame.
this way or that way?
Yes. It would be like, so when I asked the person why she scheduled what she scheduled, I didn't ask her why. I just said, oh, I'm sorry that you scheduled. Not I'm sorry. I said, oh, I tried to be up in time for this call and I'm sorry I missed it. I said, next time I'm going to try to be up for the call, even if I'm not feeling well. And inside my heart was more like, why do you always change the times? It's never consistent. That was what was in my head. Like, don't switch it all the time on me, on us. So there was like this frustration, and I was nervous that it was going to come through in my writing. Like, I wanted to be respectful. Like, she has to make a schedule according to her schedule, and she runs the call, so it is up to her.
I mean, you could just ask if there's it's hard for you to just keep adapting, and would you please, whatever it's. I mean, just take that into consideration when you schedule the classes. It's okay
Right.
to ask.
Well, what
It's
about
okay to ask.
what if you know that the person who would receive that message, kind of like through your history of your friendship, always looks at everything as an attack, even if you say it in the most kind, most productive, spiritually productive way, as you would say, it's always like an attack. It's like it's almost not worth it. But then I feel like what? I have to be shut. I have to keep my mouth closed in this. Like it's frustrating.
I mean, I think you should, not be intimidated by that
Right.
and to say what you need to say and say it in a kind way.
Okay, I hear you.
Okay.
Thank you.
So
One
I'm
thing.
not angry. I'm just disappointed. How many times have you heard someone say that to you?
Yeah.
The non-shaming rephrase is I'm not so happy with one from the internet, so I kind of wrote my own. But the non-shaming rephrase is, I expected something different. Can we talk about what happened? Meaning, I realize that my expectations were not realistic. Like, I'm not angry, just disappointed is very shaming. Like that you disappointed me is what it's saying, and it's very shaming. But to say, I realized that my expectations were not realistic. I expected something different. Can we talk about what happened? Like how did we get off, off track? It's a neutral. Sarah, do you want to, I'm going to.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Yeah, I'm also not so happy with some of these non-shaming rephrases. It just seems to me that I don't know. I guess I tend to think that taking more responsibility, not necessarily being apologetic, but being responsible for how it came out of my mouth, and so like, because it seems to me that even if you say, for example, I didn't realize it hit you this way, it to me it sounds a little condescending still. I mean, I think I would say, I'm really sorry it hit you this way, period, or something like that. I don't know. So, I mean, I agree with the idea. I just don't think I like the way they
Right.
did
I
it.
think that's nice. I mean, I think that's true what you're saying. I didn't realize that what did you say? You left out.
I'm really sorry it hit you this way. I
Right.
mean, that's why I'm not shaming myself. I'm not shaming them. It's just, that's how it landed on them, and
Right.
that's
And it
their
was not my
autonomy.
intention. That was not my intention to.
Yeah, or yeah, it wasn't my intention. Yeah, right, exactly. I don't know. I mean,
So we can improve. We can improve upon them. That's
yeah.
fair.
Yeah, I
So,
guess. I just really felt that.
yeah,
Okay.
no, that was a real improvement. I would agree with you.
And also keeping it with an open-ended statement. So you're taking responsibility for your feelings and judgments, but you're also opening up a open statement rather than making a statement of fact. You know, like that first one you had, I can't see it now, but you know, it said that on the top.
You're really sensitive.
Yeah, like, can you tell me more? You know, like, I want to know more. You know, like, it's a, you know, whereas I didn't realize that this would hit you that way. That's kind of a judgment statement, but I also felt that way. That's what Sarah, is it? Sarah Gold? Yeah, I also felt that way about some of these. Now, Woman Within has a whole bunch of these statements that I can send you that are really wonderful. That's in our shame piece. So it fits with what you're doing. But and I can try to send it, take a picture and send it to you.
That'd be great.
Okay.
Shoshana, could you please send that to our group if
How do
possible?
I? Oh, I can do that on the WhatsApp, right?
Yeah, that would be
Yeah.
amazing.
Okay, great.
Thanks.
Is Brené Brown like somebody to stay away from, or do you feel
No,
like
I
her
think she's
words are,
great. She's
you think she's
great.
great? Okay. Cool. Thank you.
I can quote her in this, actually, in this
Yeah, I
section.
think I saw. Oh, yeah.
Okay, so it's fine. I'll just do it myself, meaning, you didn't hold up your half of the sky, and now I'm stuck with both things. It's definitely a blaming. So the rephrase is, let's figure this out together so we can both feel good about it. Seems
Yeah,
neutral.
that's nice. I have a quick question around the one that came right before it. I'm not angry, just disappointed. I remember a time in recent history where I said that and it felt really hard to say, and I did feel disappointed. And the response of I realized that my expectations were not realistic. In that moment, I did have expectations that I did personally feel were realistic, and that the expectation was important for me, and that I did check in with myself authentically and feel experience disappointment. And I see how shaming that is. And I also don't know. I wouldn't want to say that it's an unrealistic expectation because it's I felt it was. So what do you think about that?
And it's interesting what you're saying, because when I wrote that one, I was, it's so obviously shaming, but it's also like a feeling that is a legitimate feeling that the person who said it is feeling. They're feeling disappointed. And so I was, and it's just a phrase that I don't think there's a parent on the planet who hasn't used it at some time or another. But I do think that because it's shaming, it is likely to have the opposite effect of what it's intending to do, because it's diminishes the person who's who has disappointed is like, it's a very diminishing thing to hear from someone who's important to you. And so I do think that the in the bigger picture, that there was, like as you said, you realized going forward that the expectations were not realistic. And so to know that if you're find yourself about to say, I'm not angry, I'm just disappointed, to remind yourself that probably your expectations were a major part of why there is disappointment here, and to kind of rephrase it in a way that acknowledges that.
Sarah, you date. I have a thought. Instead of shaming and anti-shaming, the other column would be, how can we be mutually respectful? How can I honor this person's presence in my life?
I mean, it's not anti-shaming, it's non-shaming.
Non-shaming, but
It's just a
not using
different.
the word shame, not using that word, but raising it up to a higher level of equality, I guess. Just a thought, just a thought.
I mean, because the book is about shame, so it's kind of relevant. But oh, I understand what you're saying. Okay, let's see. Okay, you always make things dramatic. You're such a drama queen. The non-shaming is, or the whatever you said, mutual. This feels intense for you. I sense that I see that this feels intense for you. Do you want to talk it through? I mean, I think that's not, there's no, I don't think there's any shaming. Do you agree?
Yeah, it's very kind. It's very kind.
Yeah, and also for sure, it's our tone of voice. Like, it can be degrading in our voice and our tonality.
Right,
So
that's
I think
true
that is a
also.
beautiful way of phrasing it. Wow, I never thought of it like that.
You just can't take a joke. I was just teaching this to someone who that's it. She had just said that in the morning. You just can't take a joke, meaning that you said something that was supposedly humorous, but it had a bite to it. And you're blaming it on the person themselves that they're super sensitive instead of, whoa, that landed wrong. I did not mean to hurt you. Let me try that again. So there, the person is taking responsibility for the fallout of their careless and kind of hidden shaming speech. You're overreacting. Again, that you're to blame for your they're to blame for their emotional response to your insensitive statement. I see you're having a strong reaction. Help me understand it. It's fair, I think. You always take things the wrong way, instead of. It seems we interpreted this differently. Can we clarify it together? So,
That's
anybody?
moving.
It's what?
Moving from you to we. In the first one, you're pointing your finger at the person, and the second one, you're acknowledging that they're both in it. You're both in it in this, and so have to work towards authentic or kindness or.
Yeah, nice. Or clarification. Can we clarify?
And you're both learners.
So anybody have anything else they want to say about this before we, PL?
I find using the word always is always a troublemaker.
Right, that
You
is true.
always, whenever you use the word always in a sentence, it always puts the other person in defense. That it's shaming just because there's never, it can't be always.
Right, that is a good point. That is a good point.
I think sorry. So I was going to ask that I'm still stuck on once I notice myself doing these subtly shaming comments, I feel really stuck. And then the shame comes in really big. The shame of
But it's
finding
not,
that.
it doesn't have to be so hard. Like once you realize that there is this subtlety of communication that really is profoundly significant in the end, it's really not like just like Lashon Hara, like once you kind of get over that hump of the strangeness of it or whatever, then it becomes kind of natural, and it's really it's not I find that it just is a habit now to like I say a sentence in my head and then I immediately assess its shame impact and just find a way to just readjust the words. It's not asking a lot. It really isn't.
to getting stuck in like this shame. It feels like a shame spasm of like, oh my gosh, what is it in me that's making me talk this way?
So it's good to ask yourself that question of that is a good question. What is it? What am I? Why am I attached to saying it in a way that is has a shame impact? Like there is, it is a there is a strange pleasure in that, that is important to acknowledge, to see, and to admit. And then, but once, but you know, so you have a learning curve. I'm in the learning curve, and I'm, and there's nothing for me to be ashamed about. I'm just trying to train myself. It's an old and bad habit that I'm trying to train myself out of.
Okay, so understanding this is the human journey as
Yeah.
opposed to being ashamed about it.
And we,
Okay.
you know, it's like, I mean, I think because of millennia of child of using shame to train children to behave, that it's no blame. It's like kind of in our deep, a millennia of training that's just deep in our psyche that we have to, once we see it, it's really not so difficult to let it go, but it definitely is in there.
Okay, I'm not seeing it as so simple, but I'm gonna try to see it. Thank
Okay.
you.
Yeah.
Yes. Thank you.
Couldn't you think about it like exercise? Like you have to train the muscle. I remember when I was young, I used to curse a lot, and then I didn't like that about myself. And I had a friend.
I have all my underwear on.
We made an agreement that we wouldn't curse anymore. So we made up a whole other language. So it's no one knew we were cursing, and then it's sort of. And then it sort of took out the charge of the cursing. And so after that, like a year later, here I'm 19 years old, and you know, I was saying, you know, like fuck you all the time. And when somebody said the word, I was like, ooh, my body just went like, ugh, you know, because I had trained that muscle to not be to be sensitive to it. Whereas before it was like, you know, came out of my mouth every, you know, every other sentence. So I think it's like a gym, like a non-shaming gym, you know, you to get
Right,
those phrases.
that's a great metaphor because that really is. It just is a practice. It's just a practice, and it really you'll see it's not so far-fetched. You know, it's not. It's you know,
But not to
it
shame
comes
yourself,
natural very soon.
but also
Yeah.
not to shame yourself if you're not there. Like give
Right.
yourself time, be kind to yourself, you know. You're going to make mistakes and you're going to fall, so it's okay, you know.
Right.
It seems to me that, I mean, I agree there's a sort of a training approach and a sort of a mechanical approach to this, but I also think that it comes from the heart. And that if you really care and have empathy towards the other person and their feelings, that it'll be much easier. Like it cuts a lot of corners to, you know, just to know what the right thing is to say. You say, like, how would I feel if I were receiving this? And so I think just sort of tuning into one's own heart and the com the, you know, this is another human being opposite me, I think would, you know, make it a lot easier just to
Right.
intuitively know what to say.
And it's like the also a little bit chicken or the egg, because also the developing the sensitivity does it forces you to really have a different kind of compassion for the person when you're consciously making a decision not to shame them, but to say things this way instead of that. It is a it inculcates a certain kind of compassion towards people and towards that person also. It has that side effect,
Definitely.
beneficial side effect. Okay, so what I want to do then is to just read the text that was behind this. Wait a minute.
What
Wait.
page again? 260 something, right?
Yeah. Let's see.
246.
Oh, 246. Thank you.
46. Do you see the page on the screen or not? No. Okay, wait a minute. Share. Okay, so this is 246 bottom. Don't shame people. It's essential to pay attention to how we communicate with others in ways that might be even inadvertently shaming towards them. When relaying information that will be potentially triggering for another person, it's important to take a moment before the fact to formulate the message in a way that will minimize their ego discomfort. True, the rebuke itself, by definition, is uncomfortable and unavoidably shaming. Consequently, Jewish law rules that although it is an obligation to deliver rebuke, if we can't do so as much as possible in a kind and non-shaming way, then we are forbidden from fulfilling the mitzvah. In sensitizing ourselves to this requirement, it helps to debrief our intentions and notice when people get defensive or shut down, including ourselves. Was there another way to say what needed to be said that would have been less shaming? As parents, friends, or employers, we must remember that people are much more responsive to requests or suggestions when they do not feel shamed by them. Reflecting on our actions and conversations from this angle is important, not just for the recipient of rebuke, but for the rebuker as well. For even when the shaming is unintentional, the spiritual consequences for the shamer are severe. There are at least 100 references in Jewish canonical writings to the despicability of shaming another and the severe spiritual consequences of that transgression, i.e., losing one's portion in the world to come, which, from a Talmudic perspective, is the worst of all fates. This includes such seemingly innocent things as asking a teacher in public a question that is not confined to the subject at hand. The teacher's memory is likely not refreshed on that matter, which means that he or she will answer incorrectly or have to admit not knowing, both of which are likely to cause shame. Another example is not to mention the previous escapades of a person's wild youth, even as a friendly tease or even as shared memory, because there is the danger, if not likelihood, that it will cause a tinge of blame. There are numerous stories of scholars bearing substantial loss, financial or reputational, to protect a colleague from shame, or finding the gentlest words to inform a fellow rabbi that he's been excommunicated. There's the famous story of Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Eliezer when he was excommunicated by Rabban Gamliel, and the colleagues came together to try to devise a way to communicate to Rabbi Eliezer the heart-wrenching news that he was in cherem, that he was being put into cherem or excommunication by his Rebbe, Rabban Gamliel. And finally, they chose Rabbi Akiva because he was the most gentle-hearted and compassionate of them all. And it describes how Rabbi Akiva came in and sat some distance from Rabbi Eliezer and was wearing black. And he didn't use the word, he found a way to tell him that he was excommunicated without using the word cherem, which would be such a shock. And so he, said, Rabbi Eliezer, I see that your friends are sitting some distance from you today. And that's all he had to say. And the Rabbi Eliezer looked at Rabbi Akiva, who also was distant from him and was wearing black, and he understood what Rabbi Akiva was communicating. And he cried and kind of tore kriya and fell to the ground. And it says that in terms of the issue of shame and the intensity of the uncontrolled state of shame, it says that for in Re that when Rabbi Eliezer, the pain that he felt and the shame that he felt from being shamed, from being excommunicated, it says that it reverberated through the whole land of Eretz Yisrael, and a third of olives were destroyed, a third of wheat was destroyed, and even the dough in women's hands was spoiled. So just to convey, there's also the story of Rabbi Yochanan and Reish Lakish, where they were in their chavruta, and Rabbi Yochanan said something that insulted Rabbi Reish Lakish, and Reish Lakish responded with a equally shaming quip, and they what oh and so they their chavruta dissolved, and it says that
Hope it's okay.
Rabbi Yochanan was
You
so
talk to them or?
what Rabbi Yochanan. It's okay. Rabbi Yochanan was so offended that his wife kept him from saying Tachanun, which is the because she knew that if he said Tachanun when Reish Lakish was around, he would he his pain of shame would cause Rabbi Reish Lakish to die, would cause his death. And in fact, one time Reish Lakish was there, she missed the moment or whatever. And that's exactly what happened. Rabbi Yochanan said his Tachanun while Reish Lakish was there. And it ca actually caused Reish Lakish's death. So just that to understand the for like that shame is no joke. And the more evolved the person, the more impactful their emotions, even their negative state emotions. And so Rabbi Yochanan really like epitomizes that. Like you might think that an evolved person doesn't feel shame, but shame is it's just a very deep and primal emotion or discomfort. That it's the first emotion, as we saw, it's the first emotion that's mentioned in the Torah. It's very in there at the root level of our psyche. And there's something I was going to say. What was it?
Sorry, someone is asking a great question. These stories are so beautiful. Are they in the book? I'm just repeating what was texted to you just now. No. Is there a way to get hold of these stories? Because I know they're in the Gemara.
I have the papers here, so I can easily I can put them on the I can attach them to the sound file when I send it.
Oh, beautiful. Thank you. Why did the wheat in their hands and the, I understand you're saying that there's a sensitivity, there's an energy that's even found in the food. And because he's such a, is that what you're saying? Like even the food was
And
sensitive?
that shame is so, it's so like shame is spiritual nausea. Like in nausea, there's no place that you can find relief. There's no safe space. However you move, it's just unless you get rid of whatever it is that's making you nauseous, it's just a global discomfort. And so that is the discomfort of shame. Shame is spiritual nausea. There's just no space for relief. It's whatever you do, whatever you say, that still burns. And the ego needs to get rid of it. And so it like just dispels, try, you know, dispels it, whatever it needs to do. It's like it's mercenary. It just needs to dispel it. And so it's saying that that dispelled shame is like affects the entire ecosystem of wherever that person is. And it's really a shocking thing to realize that, you know, and so on we're on smaller scales, we're for sure, but that shaming someone has something of that, even the little shaming that we exchange has something of that effect to it. Cultivating a consciousness of shaming words and the subtle ways that we insert them into conversations and experience others doing so is probably the most powerful of preventative tools. It sharpens one's sensitivity to the symptoms of shame in others and heightens one's awareness to the flashes of shame inside ourselves.
Sarah, you did?
Yeah.
I have a question about our arrogance and our not doing shame directly, but by putting other people down, you know, like
That's me.
my arrogance as a Jew sometimes will put other people or other faiths down. That is a form of shame, isn't it? Even though I don't do it directly, it's
Yeah, we're defining shame in such a general way as a discomfort produced when the ego feels diminished or deflated.
so
So,
it's my way of feeling good about myself and putting other people down.
yeah, it can't be. There's all kinds of motives for
Right.
things, but yeah, that's certainly one of them.
Okay. Thank you. I'll
Okay.
stop.
Yeah, we're able to make crit, you know, we are, it, you know, we do make legitimate judgments about what's good, what's not good, what we are drawn to, what we're not drawn to. Just that's life. But we need to try to do it in a way that is respect, like gives the other person some dalet amot to stand in and to be respected.
Thank you.
Okay, so now we're getting into the nitty-gritty, which is an actual shame spasm. The other ones were the attitude change and the proactive, just kind of preparing ourselves, girding our loins, so to speak, so that when shame comes our way, we'll be able to work with it productively. So now we're really like kind of in the nitty-gritty. A shame spasm has entered. It could be ours, it could be someone else's, and how to deal with it. And some of this, I'm sure, will be self-evident, but I think it also will have some helpful advices as well. Okay, so reactive shame practices, how to manage a shame spasm. So the first step is to acknowledge that we're in a shame spasm, or that someone is that we're with is in a shame spasm, and to label it. And that has benefits. First of all, you know, just like we don't like to be labeled because it's diminishing, you know, we're more than that label. So it also can be used in an for our benefit by labeling something like this emotion that has overcome us, to label it as, oh, it's just a shame spasm, and it does diminish its power. It's just a shame spasm. It's, you know, I've been here before, we'll get over it. And so that it's one thing that acknowledging it has several benefits. Over time, we'll start to also to recognize a shame spasm's early symptoms. And this will enable us to address the problem sooner and thereby spend less time in an unpleasant shame state. Like the Like it's kind of while the burning that kind of comes in, it is we kind of get lost in the discomfort and forget ourselves. We lose ourselves in shame. And so labeling it as a shame spasm is a way of recovering ourself and our ability to master the situation. It's just an emotion. I'm here and I can work with this. I can, it's manageable. We'll find our way through it. And the more and sooner that we can recognize it and label it as a shame spasm, the sooner we'll be able to begin to work with it or kind of detach from it to some degree. The sooner we catch and label shame, the less likely we are to do something rash that we'll regret afterwards. Like if we are dealing with a situation and reacting to it, we're likely to say things or do things that we regret afterwards. The second step is to stop, breathe, acknowledge the discomfort, and begin to just notice its symptoms, like to see how our physiology and psychology reacts to manifest shame or shame spasm, because people are different. So to begin to note, where in my body do I feel the distress? My stomach, my head, how does my body react? Shortened breath, racing thoughts, am I sweating? Am I chilled, restless, tense? Has the shame triggered fear, anger, hate, frustration, self-contempt? What emotions are coming up? These are just really important things to identify, because the information is useful, and also because it helps in kind of the identification of what's going on. How long does a shame spasm last? Minutes, hours, days, weeks? Does it vary depending on who, when, where? Does it leave a residue? Do I carry traces of grudge, resentment, insecurity, or fear, even after I've resolved to move on? That's, kind of in this whole issue of shame and the kind of interactions of it. The two mitzvot d'oraita that apply to shame are the prohibition of holding a grudge or seeking revenge. And those are, when someone shames you, those are difficult things to observe. Those are difficult mitzvot, because shame, as Rebbe Eliezer and Rebbe Yochanan demonstrated, shame really gets to the core of things and really is just a profound and unbearable discomfort. And so it's hard not to, I mean, it's difficult not to hold a grudge. I mean, Rebbe Yochanan, somehow it's not considered holding a grudge, but it's closely looks like that. And exploring the okay and also okay exploring these questions pulls us into, this is one of the benefits of making this inventory, is that exploring these questions pulls us into witness mode, which creates distance between us and the shame state itself. Like when we start looking at what's happening inside us physically, physiologically, emotionally, we kind of get out of ourselves in a certain way, and it creates distance between us and the shame state itself. And as we begin to pay attention, patterns will emerge over time, and that should help to manage the symptoms, even if we can't address the cause in the moment. But that it enables us to bring a certain or begin to find our way to some more inner peace or quiet, even though the shame isn't gone, but we're kind of able to manage it in a more by taking the inventory. It's also valuable, and sometimes there's nothing to do about it. Like, it's not like you can't make the shame go away. It's also valuable to just sit and watch how the ego squirms from shame. I mean, it's painful to see the ego squirm because it can't tolerate the discomfort of shame. And so it will just try anything in its power to off put the shame to and it'll try this and it'll try that, and it'll try to change the story a little bit to make it sound a little bit less, and maybe change the order of the conversation so that you really did say the one thing at this point of the conversation and not that point of the conversation. And just all those things that it is the desperation that it demonstrates of needing to just get rid of the shame. It's just something to observe. And to observe really compassionately. The practice and the challenge is sometimes to not interfere, to just observe. There's so much to learn about ourselves by the desperation that shame triggers inside the ego. If possible, step away and collect yourself. Unfortunately, that option is not always available, as when we're in the middle of a board meeting or a Thanksgiving dinner. In some situations, it might be possible to say something like, "I can feel that I've been triggered," which means that it won't be productive to continue this conversation right now. I won't be able to take in what you're saying, and I won't be able to express myself properly either. Let's pause and continue in a few hours or tomorrow when I'm calmer. So that's a pretty neutral and unprovoking way to kind of get some relief from the intensity of the shame spasm that has somehow slipped in. Sometimes it's the other person who has been triggered, and he or she might get defensive if you point out, "I see that you're in a shame spasm. Let's leave this for another day." They might get defensive if that's pointed out. So in that case, it's best to ascribe the triggering to oneself and to say that I'm the one that needs the time out, even though in reality you're doing it for their sake because they are unleashed. Whatever happens, remember Brené Brown's three T's: don't text, don't type, don't talk. It's really true. When you go into a shame spasm, you're in mochi dikkatnut. And when you're in mochi dikkatnut, there's no telling what you're going to say. And especially in the accusations that are going, when accusations are going back and forth. And it's, I'm not exaggerating. It is extremely dangerous. I know, I mean, I witnessed a situation where a person just speaking in their shame, like out of control, said something, and it was so hurtful that the whole relationship just dissolved. In that, it was a sister's, a whole, their whole, like, and it's been years. In the midst of a shame spasm, our psyche regresses into a state that Kabbalah calls mochin dikatnut, narrow, constricted, childish consciousness. It's 99% certain that whatever we say or convey while possessed by Mohini de Cotnut, we are bound to regret it when our nervous system relaxes and returns to itself. I mean, that is really, I mean, that is a rule that you have to commit yourself to, because it's no joke. It's just dangerous. Hurtful words, once spoken, leave their impression, even when both people know that the speaker was seized by a shame spasm and was effectively out of their mind. Still, those cutting words, even though the one who spoke them really didn't mean them, they were just in their anger, can destroy a relationship forever, wreck an entire family, or create a multi-generational feud. So don't type, don't text, don't talk. Wait until you've quieted down and process the matter, ideally with a confidant or a therapist, or even just through honest journaling. Once you're able to reflect on the incident, it's good to explore the question, where does it hurt? Shame inevitably traces back to an ego wound. Whatever the present story may be, underneath it all, there's some kind of ego distress that's producing the shame. The discomfort could be perfectly legitimate or overly reactive, or all points in between. It's very helpful to get to the bottom of it, yet it's also very risky. Wait, it's very del work. It takes honesty. Where I lost my place. Like, it's very helpful to get to the bottom of it, yet it's also very delicate work. It takes honesty, persistence, and vulnerability to face your shame. This is difficult, even when no one else is listening. Just speaking your shame out loud or writing it down can be challenging for the ego. An example of how this might work through self-reflective journaling and the questions one might ask. Wait a minute, this is maybe another section. Okay, we have enough time. Okay. Wait, does anybody want to say anything about what we have so far?
I have a question.
Okay, Rebecca.
Hi, thank you. It's backtracking a little bit to the losing one's place in Olam Haba, being put in the sherem, and I wanted to, as averse as I am to shame, there's a black and white, harsh, toxic flavor that alarmed me in hearing some of this, whatever it was in the Gomorrah, wherever it was, whoever it's being talked about. I have no idea like what the things were over there, but it's just I mean, you know, as a therapist, I work with people all day long with shame and with the behaviors it created and all of that stuff. And I'm constantly working with people finding the healing or like, wow, I really did this. Like if you hold yourself in good loving regard and do the repair work to get out of the black and white, it's scary. It's a little bit different, but I remember at the end of my mother's life, I'd heard for so long with dementia, blah blah blah. Here's the morphine when you need her at the end of your life, at the end of her life, blah blah blah. And at the end, I was terrified that she could vomit or not breathe. I didn't know like. A rabbi came to my house after my mother died and said, well, you know, if you take a second away from somebody's life, it's like you murdered them. And I'm like, that's what you're giving me in my shiva? Are you kidding me? So when we do these you know, and I had to really work on, I was like horrified, like, oh my God. And it's not quite shame. It's a little bit like more of a
No,
drastic.
it's shame. That's a shaming statement. I mean, yeah.
These crazy, like if you take a second away, there's something scary and all those flavors that.
Right, but when you're a Talmudist or Talmud Chacham, like you know that the Talmud is always speaking, there's always a paradoxical countertruth to everything that it's saying. Eilu ve'eilu divrei Elokim chayim. And so it says like absolutes, but then it gives another absolute that's the opposite of that. And then even another absolute that is, and so it knows that you're. It's expressed that each one of those absolutes is expressing a truth that is tempered by all the counter truths, and which you also know, you know, because you know the Talmud from beginning to end, and so you know how to hold all that and to balance it properly. Whereas, you know, have we coming in who don't know the whole Talmud from beginning to end, and so someone says something and it seems like it's the end all and be all of truth and reality, when really it's just a, you know, one among 20 different truths that apply to the situation at hand. So, yeah,
Again, as seriously as I take it, the severity implied in some of the things I'm hearing, not from you, but from some of the sources, it makes me think I should never open my mouth for the rest of my life, which is also a problem because we need intervention, and I am a therapist. But it's like, wow, that serious, and the more you work on it, the more refined the punishments are, so to speak.
Right, but then you just have to like know and ask yourself, or you know, track down with AI. It's you can just ask the question even, what is the paradoxical counter truth to this, you know, like kind of Talmudic assertion or this, you know, this halacha or this whatever, and you'll see that it's actually it's very it's a very beautiful way to express complex truths by like sorting out each element of tr each truth that applies to the question at hand, and that and to be able to, you know, kind of hold them all together and to get the gestalt, the higher integrative truth that holds all of the inputs. I didn't express it so well, but yeah.
But in your book, You Are What You Hate, you talk about this idea of you're the mirror. If it's triggering you, it's something in you, or else you wouldn't get triggered. So seeing that other that trigger or that hiccup or whatever it is as a shliach for the work that you need to do, because you can't change somebody else, but you can change your reaction to that situation. And then what your goal is your goal to have a relationship or to be right? And sometimes if you want to have a relationship, you can't be right. So you've got to give it up. And that's a very freeing thing to know that I don't have to be right. You know, and I don't have to defend myself. I can just be present and see how those triggers in my body or in my sensory systems and in my mind, how is that affecting my life and how do I change my reaction? So it becomes your responsibility. And also, I thought of like the dangerous part was Shimon Bar Yochai when he came out of the this cave and he and all these people were dying because he was judging them. Like that's what we do. You know, if we're not careful, we can judge and lose those relationships. And that's a beautiful. He had to go back in the cave till he really.
No, Shoshana, I appreciate what you're talking about. My gosh. Because when you just said that, that's exactly what I was thinking about with the whole story with Yosef. For some reason, my brain also went to Rabbi Akiva. Like, how did he handle that when he saw people and he, you know, that whole
Yeah,
story?
amazing, amazing.
It's amazing. And also, even how Yosef HaTzadik was able to navigate the whole situation without, I mean, did he shame his brothers at any point? I'm just so curious. I don't know what the Torah says enough about it, but the Mefarshim might say, but like, I would love to dig into that one time.
And also what
There
Tamar
too.
did, like that was a beautiful way to not shame Yehuda. You know, like it was that's what we could be doing, but it takes strategy. You can't just, it's just not natural for a lot of us to do that. I remember when my daughter was at the Kotel one time, and she was davening, and somebody was on a cell phone or something, and this woman starts screaming at the woman who was on the cell phone. And my daughter just went up to her and said, "You know what? You're affecting everybody else with your screaming. So if you're having a problem with it, why don't you go in the back of the hotel? You know, like, don't go near this woman, and hopefully she'll stop and she'll see." But like, by screaming, you've actually created a bigger problem than if you hadn't. You're not doing anything for this woman, you know. And I thought that was a beautiful teaching that, I said, my daughter did something right, and it was like, it's true. The woman looked around and she got, put the phone down and she put it away. She didn't realize what she was doing, but this woman screaming at her was shaming her.
Right. I mean, she could have just mentioned it. She didn't have to scream, but she didn't
Right.
also didn't have to go to the other side of the hotel. She could
Right. Well,
just.
I have a sitter in my phone. So when I was in the tunnels, I was davening from my phone, and the same thing happened to me. This woman started screaming at me in Hebrew, and I don't know Hebrew. So I don't know what she's saying. And my friend was there, and she heard the Hebrew. She knows Hebrew. And she told the woman, "Look at her phone. She has a sitter there. What are you yelling at her for?" She thought I was on the phone, texting. And then she was like, "Oh, I'm so sorry." Like whatever, asleep, like, and I was like, okay, it's fine. You learned, that not everybody is texting on their phone when they're looking at their phone. There are Siddurim and Tehillim on your phone.
Sorry, Yehudi.
Yeah.
I hope I'm not gonna. Okay, well, never mind. Forget what those two words. But the sefer B'nai Machshava Tova, right?
Yeah.
I'm curious, does that sefer, I never really got into it at all. I have it somewhere. Does that actually get into, like, what if one learned that, do you think that would, because it's about having, like, working on your thoughts.
Right.
I'm just so curious if the study of that would actually helped us to control this whole thing, because I'm so interested in switching this up, because I do think I do a lot of subtle blaming of myself to others, and I just want to cut this out of my whole life.
I've never learned it. I've just skimmed over it, so I don't really know whether it
Is
but I do think that it's not more information that you need. It just is the habit of just thinking about what you say before you say it, and sorting out the like identifying potential shaming phrases and restating them. I mean, I think that's really the practice. Like,
I think I hear that. I really do hear that. I would love to say something like, last night I was out at a thing with some women, and a very good friend of mine who I spoke to earlier, never mentioned that she was coming to this thing, nor did I mention to her that I was coming, but she came with another friend, and I remember thinking, like, I can't believe she came with another friend. She didn't call me and invite me. So I said something very, like, very light about it. I'm like, "Oh, that's so nice. I wish you would have told me you were coming." And she goes, "Well, you didn't tell me you were coming." And I was like, "She has a good point. I must have shamed her, you know?" And then in my head, I'm battling myself, like, well, I signed up so long ago, and the person hosting this is one of my closest friends, and on, like, even till today, I'm still like playing like baby games in my head. Like, what did she mean by that? Does she not want to take responsibility? Is she saying, like, don't you dare tell me that I should think of you more? I don't know. Maybe I don't think of her more. I don't know. This isn't it interesting how we act like 2-year-olds in our own brains.
Totally. That's what I'm saying, is that we have this subliminal layer of ourselves that is like a 7-year-old that is,
Yes.
but
So
also
embarrassing.
it's, I mean, once you establish that this is going nowhere, it's just chatter, like it, then I focus, I meditate on Hashem's name and just like let it all go, like it, like don't let it take over moments of my consciousness, precious moments of my awakeness, by using it as a trigger to meditate on Hashem's name.
I love that idea. So it
Yeah.
doesn't matter what shape or form of the Hashem's name, or there's one
The
specifically that.
meditation on the first page of the Mishnah Berurah, which is
The
the
Yod Kei
equivalent
Vav
of
Kei with
Kabbalah.
the Yira.
Yeah. Which
Okay.
is an image or an auditory sound in your mind's ear. The yi and then va. Okay, we're out of time.
This was amazing.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Thank you.
We're going to be meeting next week, but then I have some family business in the States. I have to go for 10 days. So I think it's the 18th. Yeah. The 18th, Sunday the 18th, we won't have class, and then we'll resume the following Sunday. So next week we're on, then we're off, then we're on.
Nesiyat
Toda.
Tova.
Okay.
Thank you.
Wonderful Shavua
Thank
Tov.
you so much. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
Shavua Tov. Safe
Bye-bye.
travel.
Yeshua.
Bye-bye. Whoops.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye.